Hey, welcome to Weekend Watchlist. We back, baby. A look at what's screening and streaming brought to you by the Letterboxd Show. I'm Slim. They're Mitchell.
Hello.
She's Mia.
Hey.
And together we'll dig through what's dropping this fall in a special, super spectacular episode. And we'll also take a peek at our own watch lists.
Slim, we are so temporarily back. We've been on hiatus for many months, but the people have been demanding. They've been banging down the doors at Letterboxd HQ in Auckland, New Zealand, demanding, bring Weekend Watchlist back. Where are those crazy kids? And normally, you know, we talk about what's coming out this weekend, but we wanted to come back. We got a big, big season coming up. Awards are going to be flowing. Box office is going to be booming. And we just got to talk about all these movies coming out. We can't do it every week. There's just so much coming out. So we're going to plan everybody's movie watching. By the end of this episode, you're going to know every single movie you need to watch for the rest of 2023.
And thank God for that, because if I don't have somebody telling me what movies to watch, I will not watch any movies. So I haven't watched a single movie since Weekend Watchlist went on hiatus all those months ago. So it's really good that we are so very temporarily back.
The brat Letterboxd account has been vacant,
dry,
for months. People are wondering what's going on.
Mia has been straight shooting the newsroom again.
Mitchell, don't tell everyone about that.
Before we get into the format of this special episode, folks are probably wondering, where have you been? What have you been doing? What have we been doing, Mia?
Oh, what have we been doing? Many things, I would say. We're writing things, we're editing things, we're emailing, we're... Oh, what else? Well, we're not watching movies because we didn't have Weekend Watch List. but we are almost done with our well-deserved break. And we have... Not to tease anything, but we have some really fun ideas for the future for us three podcasting. All we can say is please be patient. And hey, we'll see what the future holds.
For now, for this episode, our plan is to run down a list of movies to add to your own watch list. Maybe some obvious ones that you already know about. We will be talking about the most anticipated movies from the Letterboxd community, the ones that are on the most amount of watch lists that are coming out for the rest of the fall. But we'll also throw in some of our own picks, maybe some that are a little, you know, sneaking a little bit under the radar for you to add on there. Maybe some movies that I really want to see that, I don't know, maybe my other two podcasters have never even heard of that they don't have any interest in. But by the end of this episode, I'm gonna get everybody on board.
Oh my, we pulled the raw data. We asked the experts at Letterboxd, get us the data on the most watchlisted movies for the rest of the year. There's one on here that I'm excited to talk about. And it rhymes with Wonka. So we'll get into it later in the episode.
It rhymes with Wonka, but it isn't Wonka.
So what, you do the math. Tonka? Maybe it's not what you're thinking. Maybe it's not what you're thinking about.
Okay.
Maybe it's not what you're thinking about. Stay tuned. You got to stick around to hear our recommendations for the rest of the year. And I think Mia is going to lead us off with maybe the most popular one so far.
That's not true. Mitchell is.
Oh, I saw the croc. Sorry. For the listener, there are emojis assigned to each movie, and I misread the crocodile emoji for the bat emoji.
There's only one person.
Those are so different animals.
People make this mistake all the time.
This is the guy who just suggested that Wonka rhymes with Wonka. So. The most anticipated movie of the fall, for the Letterboxd community is, of course... No surprise here. Killers of the Flower Moon. It's on a whopping 256,000 watch lists. That's out of control. Thor, Love, and Thunder can never.
The power of Marty.
Sorry, Marvel. You're just not getting there. Directed by a little guy, a little old Italian man by the name of Martin Scorsese. Written by Scorsese and Eric Roth from the novel by David Gran. It has, you know, it premiered at Cannes, so it does have an average rating of 3.9 so far. Pretty lofty, but we're all going to get the chance to see it soon. It's coming out in theaters October 20 from Apple Original Films, including those big old IMAX screens. You got to see DiCaprio in that IMAX. And then it'll be streaming on Apple TV Plus at a later date, TBD, but you got to see this thing in theaters. The synopsis for this one, when oil is discovered in 1920s Oklahoma under Osage Nation land, the Osage people are murdered one by one until the FBI steps in to unravel the mystery. I think there's going to be a little bit more to it than that, but I don't know. Mia, what are you hearing about Killers of the Flower Moon? What's your hype for this one?
Ooh, so we love Marty. Let's just get one thing
straight.
Get it
out in the open.
We love Marty.
Hot takes here.
Martin Scorsese, great director. Who would have thunk it? So just his name alone is enough to get me hyped. But then when you factor in how he just has this such a wonderful capacity for actually listening to communities and for empathy and his reverence for the highest quality stories, I just really appreciate how he took the time to talk to the Osage people about how they will be portrayed in the movie. So those are my thoughts. I just love him, and I'm excited for this one.
Mm-hmm. We all love Marty. You know, we all love The Irishman. When that came out, we were running through the streets excited for what's next. Well,
okay, one of my fears, though, is that since it's releasing on Apple, I'm scared that people are going to just throw this on while they're, like, folding laundry. And I think it's such an important story that is so intrinsic to America's history. So I'm a little bit worried about that. So as Mitchell said, please see this in the theater. It demands your attention.
I mean, how many people have Apple TV Plus? Is it a lot? Nobody knows, right? I guess this is part of the strike talk. They wanted like concrete numbers. So hopefully it's a lot. And hopefully a lot of people are able to see this after its theatrical run. I'll probably see it in theaters in IMAX.
Thank you, Slim.
I'll probably be that old man who was maybe wishing that there was a few more extra rows in the IMAX theater so that I could see the entire screen without darting around.
I've never seen anything in IMAX. I'm too scared.
I'm sorry.
Really?
You've never seen anything in IMAX?
I've never seen a single motion picture in IMAX.
Producer, can you just cut the stream?
I get motion sickness. I get nauseous. You guys ever go in those like flight simulators? I get put in those and I feel like I'm going to pass out. So I'm scared of IMAX. Maybe one day I'll do it. But for now, regular movie theater. I'm good. I'm solid.
Are you imagining IMAX as like the dome where you're like laying back and looking up at the ceiling? Because those are bad.
I just got a mental image of like a Flight of the Navigator poster, but it's Photoshop with Mitchell's face on it. Like that kid riding that alien.
Let's be honest. Ship. I've never been in an IMAX theater, so I don't know what it is, but okay. It sounds terrifying to me.
Okay. There's only one way to find out. We'll all do it together. Mm-hmm. You know,
we'll go see Killers of the Flower Moon together. Yeah. My first
flies
one.
Out.
My first IMAX.
We'll do it as a team. It'll be amazing. It's a long movie. I will say this. There's a lot of buzz. This is a long movie. What, it's like 6 hours long?
Yeah, I believe it's about 6 or 7 hours.
That's what they keep saying.
Oh, boy. I'm excited. So, Mitchell, IMAX aside, you excited to see this?
Yeah, I'm really excited to see it. As Mia was talking about, like, I definitely had hesitations at first about like a white man being at the helm of this story, even with like, you know, you take into consideration it's Martin Scorsese. This is the guy who made World Cinema Project to like bring up, you know, these forgotten, hidden, lost films from so many different cultures. Like he's been such a vital component of spreading, you know, the love of cinema for cultures from everybody. But you know, it gets a little bit, you know, you get a little bit worried, but Brian Formo wrote a two-part, like an excellent feature on Journal earlier this year from a chat that Scorsese had at CinemaCon that really like detailed what Mia was saying, like all of the care that was given at every step of this production, including feedback from the Osage community that altered what we're seeing on screen. I'll read one excerpt from that Journal story, which is a quote from former Osage chief Jim Gray, where in the story it says, Gray told RogerEbert.com that he believed the COVID shutdowns helped Scorsese and company reshape the script, affording more time for the Osage community to provide input. An early dinner gathering was an opportunity to exchange ideas of concepts that aren't in the book, although helpful for Scorsese to incorporate. So it definitely sounds like Scorsese was spending a lot of time, even throughout production, like changing the script to incorporate feedback from the community to make it, you know, a more substantial piece of film that we're going to be able to see. And that's extremely exciting.
So one good thing came out of COVID. Exactly one good thing, I would say. Okay, well, now it's my turn to pick a movie that somehow did not make it into the top five. That's okay. This little number is called May December. Directed by my man Todd Haynes, written by Sammy Birch and Alex Mechanic. This has a 3.8 average rating as it premiered as the opening night selection at NYFF, and it also played at Cannes. So this is going to be in theaters starting November 17th before streaming on Netflix December 1st. So I guess I have a similar fear that I had with Killers of the Flower Moon, where people will watch this while folding their laundry and missing out on the antics of Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. Do you guys want to know what the movie's about?
I want to know what it's about.
Are you sold already on just Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman and Todd Haynes? Because that's all I need.
I'm sure that'll be enough for most people that are on Letterboxd.
Yeah, but just in case you want to know more, here is what the film is about. 20 years after their notorious tabloid romance gripped the nation, a married couple buckles under the pressure when an actress arrives to do research for a film about their past.
Todd Haynes, I think the first Todd Haynes movie I saw was for the Letterboxd show, and it was Carol.
Ah!
I enjoyed Carol. So going into this episode, I've seen the kind of like posters of the two amazing actresses and like, you know, they're staring at a mirror. Ooh, what's going on?
Ooh, mirror, fractured identity, perhaps? Exploring themes of persona.
Yes, very much so. So I had no idea what this movie was really even about. I saw a few comments circulating, people like didn't like how it was focusing on a certain story. So I watched the trailer and I was like, oh my God, this trailer looked nuts. I was like blown away by, I thought the trailer itself was spellbinding. Seeing Natalie Portman kind of like studying their real life and slowly becoming more like her. So I'm infinitely more fascinated to see this movie than any of actually just the still images and knowing about the cast, but I had no idea that this was the story. Mitchell, did you have any inclination? Did you hear any buzz when this movie was like being announced and stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm a really big fan of Todd Haynes. I love Safe, his movie with Julianne Moore from the 90s. Him and Julianne Moore have been working together like a ton over Far From Heaven. They did together. She had a small part in I'm Not There. Like they've done a ton of stuff together. And so like it's one of those movies where I'm like, oh, Todd Haynes has a new movie coming out. Like, I don't care what it's about. Like, I'm in. Like, I'm super excited. But yeah, learning more and more about what it's about. It's loosely based on a true story of this woman, Mary Kay Letourneau, who, like, I was not familiar with this story. It apparently swept the nation. Not me. I was like 7 when I guess most of this started happening. But it's similarly like a woman who pled guilty in 97 to 2 counts of felony rape of a child. Like the child was 12 years old when like sexual relations between them first occurred. He was like her student. And then it's a really, really fascinating story, really like disturbing story. Well, she went to prison and then like came out of prison and like then started getting back with him, and they had, you know, kids together and would get married eventually and all this stuff. And so like it's really interesting that Haynes is taking on that story. And then the fact that like a lot of the kind of reviews and response that I was seeing coming out of Cannes was like talking about how it's like super campy. And I can definitely see, especially in our current times, people being sort of like resistant to it. But you look at the reviews, I'll read a review from Josiah Morgan, who says, so chuffed that Todd Haynes finally made his sleazeball movie. This is a gorgeous and slippery film. Maybe the most difficult ethical provocation since Verhoeven's L. Wickedly funny and consistently just goes there. I probably need to see this another 2 or 3 times to love it fully, knowing where it ends up. But as it stands, I love the way this is derived from key ancestors Hitchcock and De Palma and Lynch, operating as a film that makes the audience its victim. Note that we become stand-ins for Charles Melton's victim, eventually both predators turning their gaze on us. And so I feel like you hear camp, you have like a certain impression, but then you see it compared to something like Elle specifically, which I think is a really interesting like endpoint to what this movie is doing, where it is taking something that is like inherently this story is melodramatic. Like it's very, you know, theatrical, but then using that as an end to interrogate these really slippery, like moral avenues, I think is really fascinating. And I'm super stoked to see what Haynes and company do with that.
I didn't see like the camp necessarily in the trailer. It felt like a really dramatic, almost thriller. And then to see some of the reviews say that it almost like kind of winks at you. In some respects, the trailer did also wink at you about like why the character of Natalie Portman would want to play such a person and why an actor would want to do that. So
it's actually, you know, I had a screenplay idea similar to this that I really think Todd Haynes ripped off. It was it was basically, what if Persona by Ingmar Bergman was a psychosexual comedy starring Emma Stone and Parker Posey? And I think my idea is pretty good, but I trust Todd Haynes to maybe pull it off with a little bit more grace.
Todd, so. The lawsuit is coming.
Yeah.
It's in the mail.
Todd, I've actually just conferenced in our legal team. Our legal team is on this call right now, and we are making moves. Sir.
I'm going to sue you over this screenplay I have not even written or started a document.
Don't say that. Mia, send it to yourself with a stamp on it that says, this was written in 2014.
Yeah, adjust the metadata.
I'm writing this now, August 3rd, 2014.
Thank you, legal team. Well, speaking of Emma Stone, she stars in a picture that is our second most watchlisted film, Poor Things. This is on 245,000 watch lists. It is directed by Yorgos Lanthimos and written by Tony McNamara, who co-wrote The Favourite, and it is from a novel by Alistair Gray. So this has already showed at Venice, where it premiered. And it just played at NYFF as well. And it is currently sitting at a beautiful 4.2 average rating on Letterboxd. I am so happy that my Yorgo stocks are paying off as they always do. So here's what the film's about. Bella Baxter is brought back to life by the brilliant and unorthodox scientist, Dr. Godwin Baxter. Hungry for the worldliness she's lacking, Bella runs off with Duncan Wedderburn, a slick and debauched lawyer, on a whirlwind adventure across the continents.
I can't make heads or tails of what's going on in this trailer. This movie looks weird, but I feel like it is going to be such a hit with a specific segment of Letterboxd members. That segment might not necessarily be me, but it sounds like it could be you, Mia.
It's me. It's me. It's me. There is a Poor Things poster behind me right now. Haven't even seen it. But it's on my wall next to my Killing of a Sacred Deer poster. I am stupidly excited for this. I have been tracking its production since it was announced, as I do with every Yorgos film. He is my favorite working director. So I'm beyond excited for this. I've heard it's like Barbie for weird brunette girls. And hey, that's me. So I will be there.
Mitchell, on a scale of 1 to 10, how excited are you for Poor Things?
I mean, I'm probably at a 10. Like, it's the hype for this movie is, like, stratospheric. I like Yorgos Lanthimos quite a bit, but especially The Lobster, but there still hasn't been the one that has been, for me, like, the one, like, this is my Yorgos movie. Like, I adore this. And so I feel like Poor Things could be it. I mean, the second that I saw that, like, still of Emma Stone standing in front of this building with a window that is like shaped in this phallic, you know, object. Like I was like, okay, like some weird stuff's going on. And then especially seeing the hype coming out of Fest, like the second that Venice screening let out, like the hype was through the roof. I'll read Steph Green's review on Letterboxd, who says, "Slicked with sexy abandon, Poor Things takes Alistair Gray's unfilmable novel from 1992 and surgically transforms it into a mordantly funny fairy tale about female agency and bodily autonomy. Flamboyant, florid, fantastic, and freakish. This might well be one of the most unique movies you'll ever see." I mean, that's hype. Like I don't watch trailers or anything, but everything I keep seeing, like little clips that I scroll, you know, feverishly scroll past the second they show up on my Twitter, or just like the still images, it definitely is giving me vibes of like what Guillermo del Toro has been doing recently with these like gothic fairy tales like Crimson Peak and Shape of Water and Nightmare Alley. And I've been loving all of those. Like aesthetically, they have just been so like different than most of what we're seeing in modern cinema. And so I'm really excited for Yorgos to just like, I just love weird shit. Like, let's just do more weird shit. And he seems like he's going like top shelf weird with this one.
Yeah, I mean, they won the Golden Lion. It won the Golden Lion at Venice. I didn't even mention that.
Do Yorgos fans have like a nickname? Do they have like, you know?
Yorgies? I don't know. I'm fine with Yorgies. Paws up, little Yorgies.
I can see you doing an introduction to a screening of a Yorgos movie, and that would be like part of your bit.
I would be doing crowd work.
The amount of crowd work alone from Mia would be off the charts.
It's my turn. It's my time to shine. I want to talk about a movie that I am extremely excited about that has one of the worst posters I've ever seen in my life, but that's not holding me back. That's not holding me back from being super stoked for The Burial, the new film from Margaret Betts, written by her and Doug Wright, based on a New Yorker article. This film is about a lawyer who helps a funeral home owner save his family business from a corporate behemoth. In a move to bring residents to a dry case, the lawyer digs up a complex web of race, power, and oppression that forces everyone to examine prejudices. What's not to like about that? This movie premiered at TIFF. It's got a limited theatrical release from Amazon on October 6th, and it's coming to my home, my sweet Amazon Prime, on my television, October 13th. Listen, this looks like the most 3.5-looking movie I've ever, you know, seen, and I am absolutely living for that. I'll tell you, I am somebody who adores a courtroom drama. I love a legal thriller. I love a courtroom drama. Give me The Firm. Give me Michael Clayton. Give me A Few Good Men, Civil Action, The Rainmaker. Like, that is my bread and butter. And we don't get these kind of movies anymore, people. I don't know why. I don't know why. They were all the rage in the 90s, and we don't get them anymore. And I need that. We as a country, I feel, have only seen our fortunes flounder since we stopped letting these movies exist. And you got a cast in this. You got Jamie Foxx, Tommy Lee Jones. When are they not good, people? When are they not good? Bill Camp? Bill Camp is in this.
What? And let's not forget Alan Ruck.
Alan Ruck. Suckheads, where you at?
Suckheads. Come on. Suckheads, where you at? We're the con heads. And maybe this will also help. The director, Margaret Betts, also directed Novitiate.
Good
movie. The lesbian nun movie with Margaret Qualley.
Diana Agron. Good movie.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So that certainly helps. I will add it to my watch list because of that, just for you, Mitchell.
Stand.
We're going to get those numbers up.
Hashtag I stand with Mitchell.
Hashtag we did it.
So I'm next, judging by the old man emoji next to this movie title, which I suggested, full disclosure. It's The Killer on our top five most watch list of movies for the rest of the year, directed by David Fincher.
Oh.
Written by Andrew Kevin Walker, based on the graphic novel, Alexis Nolan. 121,000 watch list, 3.4 average rating so far. Premiered at Venice in limited theaters October 27th from Netflix, before streaming on Netflix on November 10. Synopsis: after a fateful near miss, an assassin battles his employers and himself on an international manhunt he insists isn't personal. So I think I've known about this project for a few years, mainly only because it's based on a French comic book, which I've read. I can't read French. I've read the translated version, obviously. but this has been like one of the, in comic circles, this comic has been circulated as one to read for a long time. I think it came out maybe 2007. So I was actually pretty surprised that David Fincher picked a comic book for his next film. And to be honest, I'm excited for, you know, the follow-up to Mank. I wasn't a huge fan of Mank.
No, I don't think any of us are Mank heads.
In the notes, we all mentioned that we didn't really.
The Mankies are very quiet right now.
Respect.
Okay,
Fincher. I know your dad co-wrote it, but
yeah, we love you, Fincher.
It was a little stale,
but yeah. And so, even though I didn't like Mank, I do feel like I talk about it every day of my life for no reason. So, you know, I got to give it a point for that. I'm always saying Mank. I don't know.
They need it. They have huge mistake not putting an exclamation point at the end of that title. Mank! Yeah.
Mank!
So who's excited for The Killer and why?
I'm stoked. Yeah, I think it was indie. Like, I was very interested in him being back in, like, sort of like thriller mode. But then I saw IndieWire's review of it, compared it to Jean Dielman, and having like a sort of like neorealist vibe and observing this character's day-to-day life, which is an approach that I love for an assassin movie. Like, it makes me think of Anton Corbin's The American, which is one of my favorite movies, or Jim Jarmusch's The Limits of Control. Like, I think that that's a really interesting style. I love Serena's review on Letterboxd, who said, it took me a while to really get The Killer, but once I did, I found it irresistible. David Fincher gives us the character study of a narcissistic, extremely uninteresting man who, you know, who definitely is neither as successful nor as emotionally detached as he thinks he is, and whose journey is meant to be unrewarding. Once you stop taking our killer seriously, you'll start to really have fun with it. Which, to me, a movie where I'm supposed to find a man uninteresting and unsuccessful and just kind of a scrub, I mean, I'm it. Like, that's great. That's perfect. That's how I feel about most men most of the time.
Yeah, the poster is great. I love the design of the poster. So I'm excited to see this, methinks. You know, maybe I'm going to sit down on my couch, you know, fire this up on Netflix. This is Netflix, right?
It is Netflix.
God, how many of our top
five?
And
fold some laundry while watching.
And fold some laundry. You know, a lot of these, I mean, what was our second most popular one?
Poor things.
Okay, that's not getting digital. But at least two of our top three so far are going to streaming very soon after and are from a streamer. So that's pretty fascinating. Also want to say that like our most popular movies, I mean, when we were doing Weekend Watchlist Weekly, we weren't covering movies that were at almost 300,000 watch lists.
That's what I was saying. Like, I feel like I remember when, like, I think it was you two who did the episode on The Whale, and it was, like, at, like, over 100,000, and we were like, oh, wow, like, that's a huge number of watch lists.
Lots changed. A lot has changed since we've been gone. Long time.
And I have another movie to add to the watch list. It is called All of Us Strangers, written and directed by Andrew High, based on the novel by Taichi Yamada. This is going to be released in theaters December 22nd in the US and in the UK on January 26th from Searchlight Pictures. It is about screenwriter Adam, played by Andrew Scott. And one night in his near empty tower block in contemporary London, he has a chance encounter with his mysterious neighbor, Harry, played by Paul Mescal. And it punctures the rhythm of his everyday life. As Adam and Harry get closer, Adam is pulled back to his childhood home where he discovers that his long-dead parents are both living and look the same age as the day they died over 30 years ago.
Whoa.
Wow. So I not to brag, but I did get to see this at New York Film Festival.
Look out.
Yeah, no big deal. And I went in totally blind. I did not know anything except that it was Andrew and Paul. So I did not realize this was such like a surrealist ghost story with parents who look young and all the. So I was very taken aback in a great way. And I cried three times throughout this in public in front of my professional colleagues on the first night of New York Film Festival.
That's as many times as you cried during Mank. I think that ties it.
Oh, God, Mank. but All of Us Strangers, it's so surreal and heartbreaking, and it really, really captures like the ache of loneliness, particularly queer loneliness. And I totally understand if people don't really like this one because it can get a little bit on the nose and melodramatic occasionally, but I think it ultimately works well, and it's all anchored by Andrew Scott's magnetic performance. He is really one of our greatest working actors. Are y'all familiar with the actor Andrew Scott at all?
Hot Priest,
exactly.
Yes. The first time I saw Andrew Scott, I think, was Sherlock.
Maybe, for me, how long?
It feels like another lifetime ago.
I know, that was also where I first heard of him. But get this, he's done a lot of other stuff that, hey, is even better. So, such as All of Us Strangers.
Yeah, Fleabag. Fleabag. Right? He was
Hot Priest and
Fleabag, amazing. And then I feel like everyone has seen, look at this actor reading Shakespeare. Oh my God, Shakespeare's great. You know, the clip of him reading, like doing that one scene, To Be or Not to Be.
Hamlet. He's done Hamlet.
And everyone, I think, is like falling in love with him there. But I think it's great to see him in, you know, a movie coming up before the end of the year that hopefully a lot of people will see.
Yes. And my favorite scene is when he hits the Pax weed vape with Paul Mescal. That really resonated with me deeply. So you have that to look forward to.
I'm all for magic realism in movies. I feel like that is an untapped mini genre that I need to continue to investigate because I think Mitchell, you wrote the note about Petite Maman, that one really knocked me over. So excited to see this.
When I was looking through the reviews, I was seeing a lot of comparisons to Petite Maman and A Ghost Story and Personal Shopper and that approach and like this blend of kind of like the fantasy with these overwhelmingly devastating realities, like the world, like the kind of worlds that we take ourselves to in order to understand grief and mourning. And I think that that's a really interesting approach. I didn't know about it having that sort of element to it for a while. I was just excited about a new Andrew High movie. I love his movies, especially I think that his movies have had a lot of resonance for queer men. I remember when his film Weekend came out, I was in like my early 20s and kind of like coming to terms with my sexuality and like starting to date men for the first time. And so like seeing that movie was really impactful for me. And it seems like this is doing a similar thing for a lot of other people too. And then pushing it further as well into that kind of morning stage. Pate Duncan's review of the film says, had multiple times during this where I legitimately considered running out of the theater because of how much it hit close to home. One of the most touching examinations of internalized homophobia I've seen in ages, treating the milestone of adult gay dating with the same gravity that coming out / coming of age dramas treated that specific queer milestone. And so, I mean, that's definitely something that I felt with High's movies in general. So I'm excited to see how he taps into it again here.
And I'm excited to see how Paul King taps into the whimsical tale of Wonka.
Oh my gosh. We're going to be covering this movie for like 3 years. Every time we do a year end or year preview, it's going to
get, like, within the next 2 weeks, it's going to get announced that it got pushed back. Before this episode releases, it'll be pushed back to next year.
So this one is written by King, Paul King of Paddington fame, as well as Simon Farnaby, also of Paddington fame. And it's based on Roald Dahl's characters. This one is on 120,000 watch lists and is releasing on my 28th birthday, December 15th.
Oh my gosh.
From Warner Bros. Yeah, it is the perfect birthday treat for me specifically. I don't know if anyone else considers it a birthday treat, but who remembers? Oh, I should read the synopsis. Do you guys want to know what it's about?
Do
it doesn't even really matter.
What is Wonka about? What is Willy Wonka's movie about?
What is Wonka? It's Willy Wonka. Chuck full of ideas and determined to change the world one delectable bite at a time is proof that the best things in life begin with a dream. And if you're lucky enough to meet Willy Wonka, anything is possible.
You can't even read it. You can't even finish it.
Well, because it's not a synopsis. It's just like Wonka propaganda.
Wonka-ganda. Are you accepting the Wonka-ganda, Mitchell? Are you excited for this alleged musical version of the story?
It is a musical. It is.
Alleged.
No, it is.
Don't get all up in arms at me. The propaganda is working on me. She just like attacked me for saying alleged.
What I'll say about Wonka is that Mia Leivacino is one of my best friends in the world. I love her dearly. And I hope that this movie is everything that Mia could want for on her birthday. I'll be honest. The thing with Wonka is that this is not a movie that I would say that I'm looking forward to. I would say I also, beyond just feeling like, who needs this? Like, I'm on record as not being a big Timothée Chalamet fan. So, like,
sure.
And I have seen the trailer for this because everybody couldn't stop talking about some of his line deliveries. So I was like, all right, I got to see what this is about. Cool. And he's doing some stuff in this performance that I don't know if it's working, but maybe in context, it'll look different. But what I'll say about Wonka is that the Paul King element of it, I think, gives me a little bit of like, okay, there might be something here. Because in 2014, there was no part of me that thought, I want to see a Paddington movie. Like, you know, and Paddington meant a lot for me growing up as a kid in England. Like, Paddington was huge, but I'm like, I don't want to see like a live action Paddington movie. And both of those Paddington movies, we all know now, absolutely rule. They're two of like the sweetest comfort food movies that have ever existed. So maybe, I'm not writing off Wonka, even if theoretically I'm not super stoked for it.
I want to talk about the trailer again really quick. I have to.
Talk about it as much as you want.
Okay. Because I've watched this about 200 times, I think. And I know all of his line deliveries. I'm constantly saying them. I keep going, I'm making chocolate, of course. I think that one's my favorite one out of all of the lines. I know people are really into, so quiet up and listen down. Scratch that, reverse it. That's the one that has really taken the world by storm, but I really think we're underappreciating, I'm making chocolate, of course. And also, here we come, mama. And then there's also, who's for hover chalk? So I'm pretty prepared.
I'll say in this recording studio right now, not on air, but in the recording studio listening in is our pod producer and booker, Sophie Shin, who has put in the chat for the podcast that when she went to see Bottoms, the audience was reciting the whole entire Wonka trailer it was playing. So Mia has said, Wonka trailer quoting is sweeping the nation. They got to do one of those like riff tracks of Wonka when it comes into theaters where you just have the lyrics and all the words just on the screen at the bottom.
And you know what? I haven't even mentioned that Hugh Grant is the Oompa Loompa.
Should we mention
that
you?
I think I have to mention that. This is why I am so adamant that it is a musical, because I know that Hugh Grant is going to sing and dance as the Oompa Loompa. Hugh Loompa, if you will.
Wow.
We need to move on. This is too much. This is too much.
I don't want to. Wait, I have to say one more thing, Slim. Do we remember when I said that I would get a long-term partner for the Wonka premiere?
We all remember. We've been trying to keep track.
We're ready to hear an announcement.
Okay, here's my update. I am no closer to meeting my goal. I don't think it's going to happen. But there's still about 2 more months. So I'm still taking applications, but it's pretty competitive.
But Warner Brothers is about to push it back for another year. So you got plenty of time.
Oh my God.
I want to talk about, let's move on. You know, we'd all love to talk about Wonka all day long, but we're going to have to move on. We got to get the show on the road. I want to talk about my next pick is called Leave the World Behind, written and directed by Sam Esmail, based on a novel by Rumon Alam. This movie, it's premiering at AFI Fest at the end of this month, October 25th, and then it's releasing from Netflix on December 8th. It hasn't been too clear to me if it's like coming out, like getting a limited theatrical run like Netflix does, or if it's just going straight to streaming, but we'll find it all out. The trailer did drop for it earlier this week, so you can check out the trailer if you want. The synopsis is, a family vacation on Long Island is interrupted by two strangers bearing news of a mysterious blackout. As the threat goes more imminent, both families must decide how best to survive the potential crisis, all while grappling with their own place in this collapsing world. I love a minimalist concept. I love any kind of like Twilight Zone-y concept, which I think this definitely has, like, you know, characters in kind of a contained environment, especially like being cut off from the rest of the world and just seeing how that little like bottle makes him act. But the big hype for me on this one is Sam Esmail. He created Mr. Robot, which is a great show. Like, the second season's not great, but like it's a really good show. And even more importantly, he also created the super rad, very overlooked Amazon series Homecoming, which is like one of my favorite series to come out in a long time. And this movie reunites him with the star of the first season of Homecoming, Julia Roberts, who I'm always longing to see Julia Roberts getting, you know, big movie roles. Ticket to Paradise, we talked about it a lot last season on Weekend Watch List. I liked it. It's fine. Like, you know, it's good. It wasn't as good as I was hoping it would be. It definitely didn't, you know, give us the Julia Roberts renaissance that I was hoping for. But, I mean, this cast is stacked. It's got her. It's got Ethan Hawke, Kevin Bacon, Mahershala Ali. Like, it is going through it with this cast. But what about you guys? What do you guys think about Leave the World Behind? What did you guys think when I threw this on the list for us to talk about?
I had never even heard of this movie, but I guess the trailer went wider the last week or so, because I did start to see like things pop up in some of my like news apps and whatever. When I read the synopsis, I was like, oh God, is this another family gets kidnapped and tortured or something by like two strangers? I'm out. But then I watched the trailer and I was completely wrong. It looks pretty cool. It looks expensive. Like, it looks pretty, like, low-key expensive, like, weird end-of-the-world stuff, but you're kind of on the outskirts, so you're not really sure what's happening. And you're right, the cast is crazy. So I'm excited to see this. I went from not gonna bother to I definitely want to see this after watching the trailer.
I actually did watch Mr. Robot. I watched the hell out of Mr. Robot. And I know my dad is listening. I know he also watched Mr. Robot. He's the one who got me into it. Mitch, shout out Mitch.
Getting together.
Yep. So I am excited for this one. I also didn't really know much about it until they announced that it was going to be playing at AFI Fest, which I'll be attending. But I love the way that Sam frames his work. I love seeing the characters and like the corners of the screen and like the way that he emphasizes the landscapes around them. So I think that if nothing else, it will look amazing.
My man knows a composition. I'll tell you that.
He really does.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I started watching that TV show called From, and a lot of the composition is the same. So I wonder if that's like a trend that started with Mr. Robot, because I've never watched Mr. Robot. And I just noticed it, like, someone else doing this framing in another TV show that I missed. So when we ever add TV or series, I'll be sure to log that to keep everyone updated.
What the hell is From?
It's on MGM Plus. You don't have MGM Plus?
I'm Googling From right now.
He's Googling MGM Plus.
Created for Epix, later rebranded as MGM Plus.
The last on our top five of most watchlisted movies is Napoleon, directed by Ridley Scott, written by David Scarpa. 87,000 watchlists in theaters November 22nd from Sony Pictures before streaming another streamer on Apple TV Plus at a later date, TBD. Synopsis, a personal look at the French military leader's origins and swift, ruthless climb to emperor viewed through the prism of Napoleon's addictive, volatile relationship with his wife and one true love, Josephine. Ridley Scott back again. Remember doing these big old epics. My only note for this is that I'm excited and I love the word prism. So props to whoever put that in the synopsis. I'm excited to see this. I love these like big, long historical epics. You know, they're expensive. We don't get them a lot, but when we do, if it's from Ridley Scott, I'm gonna be in line on my couch to watch this.
Yeah. Be in line on your couch?
Yes.
I'm also excited for this one because Ridley Scott made Alien and Thelma and Louise, so we're besties for life. I also I've been really loving Vanessa Kirby. She's great in Mission Impossible, as you already know, Slim.
Yes.
And Mitchell, probably. I would say anybody listening also knows that she's great in Mission Impossible. And I really, have you seen that poster that's like, it's her kind of in profile and it has Napoleon written on her neck in red lettering?
Oh,
yeah. Posters for this movie kind of go hard.
They really do. They're getting me hyped. They're a little bit better than The Burial, I would say.
Wait a second.
I'm excited for this one. Mitchell, spill. Give us your Napoleon thoughts.
Everybody's been waiting. They're always, what's Mitchell going to think about Napoleon? Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm excited to see it. I mean, any historical epic from Ridley Scott is super cool. I actually, I appeared on a podcast this summer called The Incinerator with my pal Connor O'Donnell, where we ranked the best films from Ridley and Tony Scott together. And to prepare for it, I kind of spent my entire summer like rewatching every movie that they both directed, and especially revisiting things like Gladiator and like the absolute masterpiece that is The Kingdom of Heaven director's cut. It's made me like get even more hyped to see Napoleon, to see him dig back into like his version of these historical epics. And this is a huge passion project for him. Him and Joaquin reuniting, I think, could be really cool, as long as like, I feel like hopefully it's more Joaquin and playful, kind of silly, weirdo, like Gladiator performance mode, maybe not as much like Joker mode. Like, it's been, for me, it's been a minute since like I've seen a Joaquin performance that I really love, but like I can really love stuff that he does, and him and Ridley have done great work together. So I'm stoked to see the two of them back together. But yeah, I mean, like a big epic, like this is like Killers of the Flower Moon, one that like I really want to prioritize trying to see in theaters, because I think that it's going to just look and sound really cool in a packed theater.
Did you see Come On, Come On? I'm searching the movie to see if I can find it.
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. I love Come On, Come On. Yeah. I forgot that was more recent. Yeah. It's more like the him going hard into, you know, method. I'm a little weirdo, like, kind of like the Joker stuff, the Beau's Afraid kind of performances. I'm like, hey, buddy. Calm down. Like, let's.
My gosh. This just saying, Joaquin just canceled our podcast interview appearance after
Joaquin,
listening to Mitchell.
You know I love you, buddy. You know I love you. Leaf Phoenix.
All right. So next is my last pick to round out our 10 movies. It barely missed the top five. Just barely. Five Nights at Freddy's. That's my pick. You know, our BFFs of Blumhouse, directed by Emma Tammy, written by Emma, Seth Cudback, and Scott Cawthon. In theaters and digital, October 27th on Peacock. So you don't even have to go to the theater if you don't want. I mean, you can. Get some popcorn, support local theaters. But if you want to stay home with your son like I am and watch this, you can. Recently fired and desperate for work, a troubled young man named Mike agrees to take the position as a night security guard at an abandoned theme restaurant, Freddy's Pizzeria. But he soon discovers that nothing at Freddy's is what it seems. So this is based on a video game that my son has been talking about for years. It's like a point-and-click survival game. Remember how I'm like, I mean, the camera moves around. I was about to compare it to Myst, and I do have the old man emoji, so I'm allowed to do that. But you are the security guard in this kind of like Chuck E. Cheese where the animatronics are coming to life, and it's your job to kind of like keep them at bay. So Mitchell, I'm guessing you've never played Five Nights at Freddy's?
I've never heard of this. I hear that it's like every time that this movie gets brought up, I just hear it's a popular video game, something or other. I used to play some video games back in my day, but I have not played in a while. I've never heard of this. From the synopsis, it sounds kind of like Night of the Museum, which I think is fun. I think that's a fun concept. And so, I mean, I'll check it out. Like it sounds like it'll be a good time. I'll probably watch it on Peacock. But you know, it'll be good. Bia, what about you're a big gamer. You and Slim are the big gamers here. What about you on Five Nights at Freddy's?
I am a gamer girl. The rumors are true, but I actually have not touched this one because I don't like jump scares in video games unless it's like The Last of Us, you know? So I have a really hard time with jump scares in video games, especially if I'm playing alone. It's like, what is the fun of that? No offense to anybody who loves jump scare video games, but they're not for me. Most of what I know about this one is that I saw a lot of Five Nights at Freddy's merch at Spencer's Gifts at the mall in like maybe 2017.
Merch game is off the chart.
Yeah, there's a lot of merch.
I'm starting to get a vibe here. Spencer's kind of Gifts. Spencer's
yeah. Hot Topic. Maybe a little Journeys mixed in. The one thing I do want to say that there's a Nicolas Cage movie that came out 2 years ago.
Willy's Wonderland. Yeah, I hear that's basically Willy's Wonderland was like, they clearly couldn't get the IP for Five Nights at Freddy's. Yeah. And it's just like a ripoff of it.
Willy's Wonderland. Sounds like Wonka.
Interesting.
More Wonka-ganda.
Enough. all right, so that's the top 10 movies, Dad, your watch list segment. Real quick, let's look at our top 50 of 2023. You know, checked in on this list when we were doing Weekend Watch List Weekly to see what the highest rated movies of the year so far are, and Jack puts this list together. So I had the list pulled up. There aren't anything really shocking to me in the top five outside of Poor Things. Poor Things is already in the top five highest rated releases of 2023. So the buzz is very real.
Yeah, it definitely benefited from having, like, Killers of the Flower Moon would be in there if it hit enough ratings to hit our threshold. Poor Things definitely benefited from having several festivals it was playing at, so it like was able to hit the ratings threshold. Anatomy of a Fall is also in there from the Palme d'Or winner at Cannes, that has been playing at some festivals and comes out in U.S. theaters on the 15th of October. So there's definitely some festival stuff sneaking in there, but along with like, you know, you look through deeper in the 50, you got like John Wick 4. Some of the big hitters. Are You There, God? It's Me and Margaret still hanging on there, which is really nice to see. That's a really great movie. What about you guys? What's like your, both of you, like your favorite movie that you've seen so far this year? Oh,
you know, it's funny you say that because I was thinking of adding that question to the top of the show, but I never did.
Mm-mm.
Favorite movie this year? I got to sort by five bangs. Let me see what I come up with. And there actually isn't a ton of new movies outside of Barbie, which is probably my number one. And then also the new Ninja Turtles movie, which I loved.
I need to see that. I keep begging Sam.
It's streaming right now.
It's on Paramount Plus. Yeah, I keep like every day. I'm like, hey, we should watch that Ninja Turtles movie. They want to see it too. And we just haven't made time for it yet. We're too busy watching The Golden Bachelor.
Oh my God. What app is that on? I feel like I get promoted that show. Is that on Hulu?
It's on Hulu, yeah.
Yeah. I've seen that.
It made me cry. It made me cry within the first like 5 minutes.
Oh my God. What about you, Mitchell? What's number one so far for you?
Usually I come in with some fun takes. My top 10 last year was a little bit chaotic. Kimmy, I was riding hard last year. It's my number one. My number one right now this year, though, I'm playing it safe. I'm boring. Oppenheimer is my favorite of the year so far. I was really blown away, you know, no pun intended, blown away by that one. And like, it's really just stuck with me. But yeah, I mean, I still love Passages a lot. That's my number two. I just saw last night, I watched my screener of William Friedkin's final movie, The Caine Mutiny Court Martial. As I discussed when talking about future mega hit The Burial earlier today, I'm a big courtroom drama fan. And I loved, that's probably like my, you know, in my top three for the year, Friedkin's The Caine Mutiny. Which is very courtroom drama. Like you literally just spend the whole movie watching people sitting in and standing around chairs yelling at each other. And I was positively glued to my laptop screen for 2 hours at like 1 a.m. So I love that. People should check that out. That comes on, comes out on Paramount Plus with Showtime, like the day after this podcast drops. So
wait, isn't Showtime is included, I think, in one of the tiers.
It's in one of the tiers. Yeah.
I was about to point out your diary, you're backlogged, right? Like your last diary entry is September 26th. I mean, how many movies are waiting to be logged?
Yeah, I'm very backlogged. I finally saw Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. I thought it was okay. I have not logged that, but yeah, I've got like 7 or 8. I've got like 10 movies I've seen that I haven't logged yet.
Whoa.
Mia, off the top of your head, I'm not sure if you have your diary up, but do you have a number one so far for this year?
So I'm going to cheat. I'm going to say two of them. So one of my number ones is Beyond Utopia, directed by Madeline Gavin. It's about several North Korea defectors. So it's like hidden camera footage that goes through the perilous high-stakes journey of embedded families attempting to escape the oppression of North Korea. And we all know it's hard to escape North Korea, and it's especially hard to, you know, like film footage of the escape. It's hard to film footage of anywhere in North Korea, and it's even harder to get it out of there. So it's just amazing that this documentary was even produced in the first place. And then the fact that it's also really well made is just an added bonus. That's another one that really, really affected me emotionally. I was like on the verge of tears the entire time watching it. I watched it through Sundance, virtual Sundance. And I've heard it's finally getting distribution. So I'm really, really looking forward to it being released to the general public. I think it's really, really important. And then my other pick, because I have to do two. I'm sorry, is Past Lives.
Oh.
Yeah, I was expecting Past Lives from you. But yeah, I forgot. Yeah. Beyond Utopia, I saw it at Sundance based on your rave of it when you saw it at Sundance. I like squeezed it in at the end of my Sundance viewing. And yeah, I agree. Like, it's definitely the best documentary I've seen this year. Probably the best documentary I've seen in a while. It's really effective and I think really important. And yeah, like you said, it comes out, I think, the first week of November. So people should definitely check that out when it comes out.
We do have to thank all of our friends who are still tagging the Reviews Weekend watch list. We do occasionally take a peek to see what our friends are watching. Trip, Brian, Becky, Georgia, Steven have been logging, Caden, a bunch of friends of the show, Zach. So we just want to give props to that. I'll just real quick spotlight Becky Rice's review of Thirst. I hope the next time I F a priest, he turns out to be a vampire.
Me too, girl.
Let's get a check-in on our year so far in terms of our own watch lists, you know? We're trying to watch more movies. We're adding movies to our watch list. Maybe we'll check to see our progress has been going. I have Mia's watch list data pulled up.
Uh-oh.
I have it crunched. You added 88 movies so far this year.
Okay.
How many do you think you watched from your watch list?
I would say 50 to 60.
Oh, close. But you went over. You've watched 47. So far, of 88.
Okay.
I mean, honestly, that's a really good guess. You guessed 50. You watched 47.
Good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Okay. That's okay with me. I think that's a lot to cross off the watch list. I'm satisfied.
You're doing work.
Thank you.
You're doing work. Mitchell, I have yours pulled up.
Let's hear it. This is going to be a
Do you want to guess maybe just the added part? How many you've added to your watch list?
309.
Honestly, 353.
That's very close. I did good. That's a good guess.
And how many do you think you watched?
I will say, first of all, I'll say that there are 7 or 8 that I have watched that I have not logged yet, so they aren't in the numbers yet, but probably like 160.
200.
All right. Good 200. Guesses. Good
yeah.
guesses.
Yeah. Another, I mean, you're also doing a lot of work.
I have gone... I'm just adding more without crossing. You know, I need a moratorium on adding. So.
Mitchell has added 10 since we started recording this episode.
Keep scrolling through. Let me. Okay, I'm looking at Slim. How many do you think you've added? You are known for culling your watch list, for tailoring it, and somehow still you shuffle and you get the worst Tubi garbage I've ever heard of.
I've tried to cut it down. I was actually in there last week just removing stuff I don't even remember adding. added, I don't know. I feel like it's going to be small, but I don't remember when I first started calling. I think it was deeper into the year. Maybe 60 ads?
Good guess. 73. And so how many do you think that you've watched from your watch list over the course of all of 2023? How many
maybe
movies?
Maybe like 25.
You think you've only watched 25 movies from your watch list?
Yeah, I don't know. Because I'm trying to gauge like when I stopped adding so the number would go down, but maybe I'm way wrong.
Well, you're at 58, yeah. So.
Oh, I'm okay.
You've almost hit even in terms of the ratio
Look at
of
that.
Adding to taking off.
Very proud
Dang,
of myself.
I lost
the hardcore.
Yeah, but specifically, Mia is in last place.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But we just want to get the point across.
I see.
Should we shuffle for old time's sake? Should we go into our watch?
For old time's sake. A good shuffle. I'm pulling up the app now.
Yeah.
Everyone loves the shuffle that we heard. We did get a lot of emails. People love the watch list segment. It helps them, you know, knock movies out of their own watch list, add to their watch list. So we love to hear from folks during our hiatus. And just to reiterate, you know, we've been very busy. We have a lot of ideas. Stay tuned. That's all we can really say for the future of the three of us doing these fun community-focused shows. Mitchell, do you want to shuffle first? Let us know what you got.
Yeah, I filtered this thing by stream only. I sorted by shuffle, and my result is a film from 1950 directed by Henry King called The Gunfighter. The tagline, his only friend was his gun. His only refuge, a woman's heart. The synopsis, one of the briefest synopses I've ever seen on Letterboxd. The fastest gun in the West tries to escape his reputation. That's it. Yeah, that's all you need to know. It stars Gregory Peck. I own this on Criterion Blu-ray. Throwback, you know, we got to bring it back. Mitchell Shuffling getting a movie that they own. But it is streaming on Peacock and Tubi, if anybody wants to check it out. And, you know, who knows when we'll be back, but I'll watch it sometime within the next like week and, you know, check out my Letterboxd in a month. I'll probably log it. Mia, what about you? What are you pulling on your shuffle?
This is awesome. Okay, so I just shuffled. I got an awesome little movie called Watching the Detectives 2007. Have y'all heard of this at all?
No.
Oh, I'm delighted to get to tell you about it. It stars Cillian Murphy and Lucy Liu.
Yeah.
Looks like Michael Cera.
I thought I had heard of it as a Cillian thing.
It's a Cillian thing. So it's, the tagline is, sometimes love is stranger than fiction. So true. And it's about Neil, a self-proclaimed film geek and owner of Gumshoe Video. He's always been content to live vicariously through his favorite films noir. But when he meets Violet, a real-life femme fatale, his mundane world gets turned upside down, and the line between reality and the movies quickly begins to blur. This sounds like it'll be really good or really annoying, and nothing in between.
I'm looking at their Ayanna Murray gave it a 2.5-star review, and her review is arguably Cillian at his most baby girl. So there you go.
Okay, and Lucy Liu, like, I'm already sold. It could have any rating on Letterboxd, and I would be there. So,
Mariah E. Gates left a review. Quote, pure drivel.
1-star review. 1-star rating.
Okay. All right. But my watch list, I'm going to stream by, or short filter by stream only. Sort. Okay. The Mechanic. Charles Bronson, 1972. He has 100 ways to kill, and they all work.
What?
Poster is incredible. Streaming on Pluto, Tubi, the usual suspects.
I've seen the remake of that with Jason Statham and Ben Foster. I like the remake of that a lot. I haven't seen the original, though.
Okay.
I think you're going to do all right. I think this is probably better than...
It's a good pick for me.
Neon City... Titanic with 20,000 feet.
Titanic 2. The amount of eye rolls people had when they were listening to that episode and I got Titanic 2.
That's why they said, we can watch this. You got to go away for a while. We can't keep doing this.
Thanks so much for listening to Weekend Watchlist, brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. You can follow Mia, Mitchell, Slim, that's me, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes.
If you had the time, maybe consider rating the podcast on Spotify or leaving a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts because it helps spread the word about the show.
Thank you to our crew, production manager Sophie Shin, who was also braving the Mitski concert ticket queue during recording, editorial producer Brian Formo, and finally, Letterboxd member Trent Walton for the theme music, Eyes On. and to you for listening. Weekend Watchlist is a Tape Deck production.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.